The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I'm going to be talking about Buddhist martyrs and stillness within difficulties, which aren't completely different, because I'm sure it is not easy to die for one's faith. And some of you who are new probably don't understand why we call this Buddhist martyrs. Martyrdom is usually associated with Christianity or other religions, but not generally heard of in regard to Buddhism. And I wanted to talk a bit about how this ceremony began, when we started doing it. And it was in 1991 that we heard about, there was a discovery of a mass grave in Mongolia. And I have I spent a lot of time trying to find out as much as I could about the whole thing, and everywhere I read, it was different. You know, different amount of people who had died. I don't think people really clearly knew. So I don't know if it was one mass grave found at that time or another. But they also found another mass grave in 2003. And it is believed that 18,000 of the people who were killed were Buddhists, Buddhist monks, nuns, and lay practitioners. And I've read anywhere between 22 and 35,000 people were killed at that time, or were discovered in that first grave. In the second grave, a few other thousand were killed, and those were all Buddhists. And many other people were killed during that time. It was in the 1930s when Stalin was making a purge of Mongolia. And he wanted to control the Communist Party and the whole country. And some of the people who were killed were some of the communist leaders in Mongolia who refused to kill their own people. Some were other religious people. Some were the wealthy, the intellectuals. He really wiped out a lot of people. And he wiped out most of the monks and nuns in Mongolia. One account said that there were a few young boys who had been monks who were not killed, but they were returned to their families. And so as you can imagine, the whole country was changed. And Buddhism, that had been, I think, a very big part of that country, was no longer really there, that visibly anyway. And 700 monasteries were also destroyed, and so that only one was remaining. So it was pretty devastating. So when Reverend Master Ji, you heard about this, she wanted us to have a big memorial in memories of these people who died. And this is not the first time that Buddhists have been persecuted down the centuries, as have many other religions. Buddhism was almost wiped out in ancient India, where it began, and never has recovered from that. Again, from my readings, I've read different things. There have been persecutions in China, Tibet, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Japan, Vietnam, and Burma, if I'm correct in this. So we started the ceremony in 1991, and we have done it every year since then. And we honor and respect these Buddhists who suffered cruel deaths and offer them our gratitude for their training. However, a Buddhist martyr, when we call it a Buddhist martyr, it is not the same as it is seen in Christianity and other religions. It isn't something wonderful that they've done. It's very sad, you know, and you can imagine how difficult it must have been for these people who suddenly, you know, they were living in a peaceful country and suddenly, you know, their whole religion was pretty much wiped out and, you know, they died terrible deaths. So it isn't something that Buddhists look for. I wasn't raised a Christian, so all I had heard about martyrdom was that it was something, that it was supposed to be something great, something that was sought after, something very noble. And I looked up the word in the Wikipedia, which is the encyclopedia on the internet, and this is what it said about being a martyr. A martyr is somebody who suffers persecution and death for advocating, renouncing, refusing to renounce, and or refusing to advocate a belief or cause, usually a religious one. Most martyrs are considered holy or respected by their followers, becoming a symbol of good leadership and heroism. So this is one definition of martyr, and I think in some way are calling these people Buddhist martyrs is true because they were killed because of their faith. But from talking to people who were raised Christian, it was said that martyrdom was elevated and sanctified, and that it was considered a great virtue to be a martyr. In fact, all your sins were wiped out and you went straight to heaven. So some people sought out to be martyrs so that they could go straight to heaven. And of course, we don't see it that way. In Mongolia, the head of the Buddhist monk, the head of the Buddhist monks in Mongolia warned Buddhists and really urged them to escape. Because in Buddhism, it's generally better to live so that you can continue your practice and continue helping other beings than to die. But these Buddhists didn't have any choice. They couldn't escape. So they were all killed. And Buddhists don't believe that dying a horrible death as a martyr wipes out all your karma. I don't know if we'd be rushing to become martyrs if it did. I don't think I would. But it doesn't. It doesn't. It's just a hard way to die. And yet some people could stay still within this situation. One nun in Mongolia who held the lineage of her master returned to lay life and married another practitioner, and they hid out as lay trainees continuing to practice the Dharma in secret. And I'm sure their situation was a little bit scary. But she felt it was really important to carry on the teachings of her master and to pass it on. And the same thing happened in China. And I think many of you have read the book Bones of the Master, where a young monk is the only monk of his master who wasn't killed, and his master was too old to flee. So he fled across 3,000 miles of China, nearly starving to death, in danger all the time, because he wanted to pass on the teachings of his master. So the most important thing for Buddhists is the preservation of the Dharma. That is the most important thing. And if one can escape, it's generally good to do so. However, some felt it wasn't good. Su Yun, who was a renowned Chinese-born Chan Buddhist master and one of the most influential Buddhist teachers of the 19th and 20th centuries, stayed in his monastery when it was being threatened. And he wanted to be there with his monks. And eventually, the Chinese tried to beat him to death. They left him to die several times, but he didn't die, although anybody else would have. And after he recovered, his students, his disciples, said, you know, assumed that he had lived for their sake. And he said, no, I lived for the sake of the people who tried to kill me, because I didn't want them to have that dreadful karma. So this is someone who had gone very deeply into meditation and the Bodhisattva vow. And also, some of the Tibetan lamas who were tortured in Tibet, their greatest fear was that they would lose their compassion for the people who were torturing them. So as one goes deeper in training, the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha and the keeping true to what we know to be true becomes more important than possibly life itself. However, we don't always live up to that, and that's okay. When in thinking about this talk, one of the verses from the invocation we sang today came to mind. And it's the second verse. Many more than can be counted faced cruel death at peace undaunted, choosing Buddha over all. And I thought about this. I'm sure that many of them died at peace, because as you continue your training, the more you train, the more when you get into difficult situations, something kicks in. I don't know how that works, but it seems like you're growing your faith maybe in the dark, and you don't even know you are, but then suddenly, there it is. I had this happen twice. Once when I was having my first big surgery, abdominal surgery, in 1982, and I was meditating a lot and, not really getting the answer to what I was looking for, to go in there completely, at peace and calm and have resolved all my feelings about life and death and all that. I didn't go in there with that, but I remember clearly as I was being wheeled into surgery that something just dropped away, and I completely surrendered myself to the unborn. And it didn't really matter what happened, whether I lived or died. It was just that surrender that was important. So I know that can happen, and that there's something that's always helping us. And another time, this was, I was having, I have such a bad memory. It's really pitiful. But I think I was having the last of my wisdom teeth pulled, probably in the 80s or 90s, I can't remember. And I had gone up to I think it was Medford, to a dentist up there, you know, to talk to him before I made an appointment for the procedure. And I realized I didn't trust him. And I didn't really want to go under an anesthetic with someone there that I didn't trust. But it was too much to to change everything. Everything was in motion. And I went there, and as I was going under, it was like the faith kicked in. And it was okay. You know, there was something I could trust in. I could trust in the Buddha. I could trust in Buddha nature and something deeper. And I was fine. So many more than can be counted face cruel death at peace undaunted. I'm sure there were some who were not at peace. I'm sure there were some who were terrified, who were angry. The whole gamut of emotions, and we just don't know how we'll react, and we have to forgive ourselves for how we do react, because facing death, especially a terrible death, can be very frightening. And also, there is the Buddha that's there with us at all times. I'm not going to go in order of my notes. When I was away from here in the early 70s, I have had a problem with doubt all my life, and at one point I saw the source of it and where it, you know, where it began in this lifetime. And I was always having doubts and doubts in the training, doubts in my Buddha nature. When I first came here, I felt that I had no faith in myself. And yet, what was it that brought me here? What was it that kept me here? And after I had been a monk for only a couple of years, I think it was a couple of years, I was having grave doubts in what I was doing and thinking of leaving. And Reverend Master Jiyu caught wind of this, and she asked me to leave. And, of course, as soon as I left, the faith kicked in, and I wanted to be back. So it's interesting. When we make a mistake, sometimes we're shown that we really do have faith. It was kind of a rough time for me. I was living at the YWCA, broke, and two books kept me going, and I read them every day. One was The Light of Asia, and one is another one I'm going to quote from, And There Was Light. And thinking about this talk, I read The Light of Asia every day, the verse section. And in thinking about this talk, two lines jumped out at me. Unseen it helpeth ye with faithful hands, unheard it speaketh stronger than the storm. And this really describes it. Buddha nature is helping us at all times, and yet we don't always hear it or see it, and yet it's there, and it's stronger. It goes deeper and is stronger than all the strife of everyday life, all the doubts, all the suffering, and it's always there. And it feels like it's kind of a thread that weaves its way through our lives of training. Sometimes we feel it, sometimes we don't. It can be just a passing feeling, so we can't really rely on the feelings. But there is something deeper that we can rely on, even though it isn't always visible. But it keeps us going somehow. It keeps us going if we don't ignore it. And I was good. Now that I've lost my place, I've kind of lost track of where I'm going. But the other book that I found so helpful is a book that some of us read in the early days here. It's called And There Was Light. And it was about, it was an autobiography written by Jacques Lucyrin, who was a Frenchman who was blinded at about the age of 10. But through his blindness, he found something within himself. And There Was Light was the light he was talking about within himself. And that guided him in his life. And he joined the French resistance during World War II and eventually was captured by the Nazis and sent to one of the concentration camps. And the night he was... I've kind of lost track of where I'm going here. But anyway, the night he was captured... I know where I was going. The night he was captured, he was facing the interrogation of the Nazis the next morning. So you can imagine how he felt. So this is someone who had found a light within himself. And yet, he spent that night... his mind going crazy with fear. So it happens. You know, we think, well, I have my faith, and I'm sure that will sustain me when life is difficult. And here he is, terrified. And that's a normal human reaction. But here's what he says. And he was also afraid for his friends, that his friends, his close friends had been captured too. He didn't know. And this is what he says. I said a prayer, two prayers, and surely more. Words flowed. Then by chance I hit my elbow hard on the wall. It hit a little, and then it did me a lot of good. I cried aloud. I am alive, I am alive. One small piece of advice. In a spot like this, don't go too far afield for help. Either it is right near you, in your heart, or it is nowhere. Now remember, this is someone who is Christian, and he's talking from a Christian point of view, but it's the same thing. It is not a question of character. It is a question of reality. If you try to be strong, you will be weak. If you try to understand, you will go crazy. Don't be afraid, well, he says, to lose your soul there. No, reality is not your character, which, for its part, is only a byproduct. I can't define it. A collection of elements. Reality is here and now. It is the life you are living in the moment. Don't be afraid to lose your soul there, for God is in it. Don't even believe in yourself. Only God exists. If God's pity does not exist, then there is nothing left. From the moment when you start looking for this pity, you lay hold of it. It lives in the fact that you breathe and have and blood pulsing in your temples. If you pay strict attention, the divine pity grows and enfolds you. You are no longer the same person, believe me. And you can say to the Lord, thy will be done. This you can say, and saying it can do you nothing but good. There is forgiveness for every misery. And as misery grows, forgiveness grows along with it. I had learned many vital things during the night of July 20th, 1943. That's pretty powerful. So now I'm going to backtrack a bit. I want to talk a bit about feeling that we don't have any faith in ourselves. Because for me, that was a very painful thing. Not feeling like I could look within, that I would actually find Buddha nature within. And I know if it's true for me, I'm sure it was is true for other people as well, that you just don't believe it. You know, everybody else has Buddha nature, but I just don't think I do. And it's only a feeling. It's truly only a feeling. And we can challenge that feeling. I don't know what exactly kept me going as a monk, feeling like I didn't have any faith. But I know when I looked back 5 years later, I saw that my faith had grown. So something happens in just doing the practice. So faith isn't just a fleeting feeling. It is doing the practice, trusting in that something within that is always there. And my faith had grown because I had continued to meditate and train as best I could, because first of all, I was desperate. Because my teacher held out her faith. And if you think about it, we, those of us who are training, are holding out our faith to you. And that includes monks and lay practitioners. And because something in me knew, even though I didn't know I knew, if that makes sense. Something in us knows that there's something deeper, even though we're not aware of it. I had an interesting experience during this ceremony. I was really nervous about this talk. And during the ceremony with, you know, the singing and everybody being here, I just felt this faith. And I was just looking forward to talking and, I was trusting and everything. And then a few minutes later, it was gone. And I was all nervous again. Oh, well, do I have faith or don't I have faith? You know, can I give the talk or can't I give the talk? And you just have to, you know, in that situation, you just have to get up here and do it. And trust in that which knows. So it's not a feeling. It's doing the deed. As Reverend Master Mahon used to say, it's putting on the togs and doing the deed. There's a book called Longing for Certainty, and I could have named that book. I'm sure many of us could. I had always longed for certainty because then I wouldn't have to deal with the doubts that arose and have to train with them. But gradually I came to see that that was my training. Sometimes training in the dark. Training in the dark and training anyway. Doing the practice even though there isn't that grand certainty. And I don't know if there ever is that. I think Reverend Master Jiyu had that great certainty, and I know some of the monks have it. But for me, it seems to be that thread weaving through my training that keeps me going. And it's not something you can hold on to or pin down or know intellectually, but sometimes you don't see it, but it's always there. And sometimes when I've made a big mistake, I know the faith is there. It's very interesting. When I have gone against my true nature, you know, I've been in doubt and I've gone against my true nature, sudden, you know, as soon as I've done that, I know that I do have faith and I've made a mistake. So now I'm very, very careful not to believe in that old karma that that doubts or that tells me all kinds of different things. So how does our faith grow? I think I've talked about it. But one thing I have found that even if we're uncertain of our meditation and training, we don't know how we're doing, even if we feel like we don't have any faith in ourselves, we can take a small step into trust. Just a small step. And taking this one small step opens the door. This is what has worked for me. We challenge our fears and doubts by not running away from difficulties. When we see we can do it, we're able to trust more and then take the next step when it shows itself. And then the door opens more and then the next. And gradually we're not so afraid. By doing this, we deepen our faith and trust and lessen the grip of our delusions. So we just have to take that one step. I'm sure I'm going over my... No, I don't think I am going over. We're warned to not talk too long. I'd like to mention something that can happen when you first start to meditate, or perhaps at any time. When you first start to meditate, sometimes it feels really good or right, or you feel peaceful, you feel a stillness. Something goes deep within, and you know there's a refuge within yourself. And it's great. You found what you've been looking for. And this may continue for a while, and then it seems like it's gone, and you've lost it. And what happened to that good feeling? What happened to that peace? And then perhaps you don't see the point in meditating because it isn't making you feel good. And then perhaps you stop meditating. And you give up the practice. You lose faith in your practice. And then you either stop or you understand what we've been telling you is that it's not about peace or having a certain experience or feeling good. It's about sitting still amidst whatever is going on. So there's much more than finding the peace. The peace of the moment or the peace of the meditation period or the calmness or the quietness. There is that true refuge within, but we have to go through the difficulties of our lives, and our lives can be very difficult. There's the difficulties of just what's going on in our minds. And then there's the difficulties of what happened in our daily lives. And yet, through this practice, we can learn how to sit still within the difficulties. And sometimes we may kick and scream for a while, but then we know what's really good to do. Achalanatha over there holds out his faith to us. He is showing us that we can be unmoved amidst the fires of greed, anger, and delusion. And as we continue our practice, we have faith in that which goes deeper than our difficulties, that is more important than things working out as we would like them to. When we find all acceptance, and when we are able to accept and let go, we can know true peace. So sometimes the difficulties we engender within ourselves is that we don't want things to be as they are. But when we can accept them, then because there is more, something more important than having things go our way. And as we go on in training, we realize that keeping true to our Buddha nature, choosing Buddha over all is more important than this and that goes on in our daily lives. Now I'd like to talk about different kinds of faith. And Reverend Master Jiyu, in an article called Perfect Faith, talks about the differences between absolute or blind faith and perfect faith. And I'm not going to read this whole article. I'm just going to read a few sentences. She gave this talk during a retreat. During this retreat, the one very important point I have been endeavoring to make clear is the difference between perfect faith and absolute faith. Far too many people feel that if you come to a monastery, you have to give up your will and blindly follow everything you are told. Perfect faith, however, does not require this. What it does require is that you accept everything with a positive attitude of mind. Absolute faith, which is a requirement of many religions, differs from perfect faith in that absolute faith implies a hardness, with no means whatsoever of allowing for softness or change. It is absolute. There can be no differences or movement within it. Absolute faith is rigid and results in bigotry, fear, and frequently in the giving up of the will. Perfect faith is full of lightness and acceptance. It is softer than a cloud, yet harder than a diamond. It is all of these things and changes constantly in a positive direction. If your master tells the disciple that he must have perfect faith in that which is greater than both master and disciple, which is indeed the true master, the disciple is in a totally different situation than if he said, requires him to have absolute faith in him, in the master. This true master should not be understood as a god or other entity. It is the essence of all things, totally empty, the fullest emptiness. So I wanted to talk about this because the faith that we find in the unborn is not a faith based on absolute or blind faith or in a God that oversees everything that goes on and that then can't be trusted when terrible things happen. And I have heard people say this and that, you know, I've lost my faith in God because this tragedy happened. Because their faith depended on things going a certain way. But in Buddhism, it doesn't depend on that. You can have faith in the most tragic of situations because God doesn't control it. The unborn isn't like a God that controls things. It's just always there helping us. So people who have this kind of concept of God can lose their faith and everything they believe in under very difficult circumstances. And the faith that you find through this practice is a faith based on experience. The Buddha taught that you need to make this practice true for yourself by doing it and then seeing the results. So it isn't something that we blindly believe or that we know through the intellect, because that can be lost. But it's a faith that grows through doing this training and seeing that it works, that the training works, and that there is a refuge that we can rely on. And that's a faith that we don't really lose, even though doubts may arise and pass. So in this same book, And There Was Light, that I was quoting from, Jack Lucieron talks, I already told about that. He talks about what happened when he eventually did end up in the concentration camp. He actually did okay because he'd found that refuge within, and he relied on that. But people who had just had their refuge in their intellect or in who they were or in the absolute faith of their religion that didn't go deeper with experience, they fell apart. They crumbled because everything was stripped away in the concentration camp and they couldn't rely on anything of that nature. And perhaps they didn't have the true faith to look within. But there were those who did. And they helped the others. They helped many people to survive by holding out their faith to them. So I guess that's it. I wanted to end on something on some wonderful quote or I hope this doesn't sound too heavy. I think for me, studying about Buddhist martyrs and, you know, the difficulties we can encounter in life, you know, can be a pretty heavy topic. However, the bright side is that there is something deeper, something we can rely on, no matter what is going on. And it doesn't... in one sense, it doesn't depend on how much training you've done, although the training you have done helps you to see it, but the help is always given no matter what. The unborn doesn't dish out help to those who've been training for a long time and not to those who are new to practice or who don't believe. Help is given to all beings at all times. There is no judgment. It is just always there helping us. But when you don't have faith, it's perhaps harder to see. And so it's very valuable to do this practice and to keep on going no matter what, because if you persevere, you will find what you are looking for. So thank you.